Product Breakfast Club. Hello, everybody. Jonathan here from the Product Breakfast Club, and it's another guest. We have another guest this week. I cannot believe it. Well, I can't believe it, but you know, the Product Breakfast Club is not usually a guest show. It's usually myself, Jonathan Courtney, and Jake Knapp. Jake Knapp is the New York Times bestselling author of Sprint, and the usual episodes are sort of a ramble-a-thon around the product and design world. And today we have a special guest, and his name is Scott Belsky. Now, Scott Belsky is an executive, entrepreneur, author, and investor, an all-round product obsessive. I'm literally reading this directly from his website because I think it's good to just get the official bit at the start. So he's currently serving as Adobe's chief product officer, woo, and executive vice president, woo, that's a pretty big one, of Creative Cloud. So Scott's passion is to make the creative world more productive. And to be honest, that's what stuck with me many, many years ago when I read the book Making Ideas Happen. But what I loved about Making Ideas Happen, this really, really blew me away, was the focus on the fact that ideas are worthless if you can't make them happen. And generating new ideas is easy, but executing them is hard. And it's something that has stuck with me through all of my product work and company building work for the last 7 years. So it's been a huge thing. I've also been to his conference, 99U, a lot of times. He also made a little product called Behance. I guess you may have heard of that. So the conversation I had with Scott that you're about to hear was focused more around his new book, The Messy Middle. And The Messy Middle is something that I've been really, really interested in. I've been watching his talks. I've been reading his blog posts. And The Messy Middle is really about looking at the inside journey of building a company or building a product, the kind of messy part that people don't usually talk about, the stressful parts, the bits that make you want to stop. I think for me as a business owner who's, I guess, in this messy middle right now, I was being very selfish again and asking questions that were specifically interesting to me, and hopefully also some of them are interesting to you. Right at the end of the podcast, I ask Scott to chat a little bit more about products and focus a little bit more about products, but I'm going to be super honest. Like, I could have asked so many more questions as this guy is like the product guru. But in the same week, he was on Gary Vaynerchuk's podcast and Tim Ferriss's podcast talking about a lot of this stuff. So I thought I would just go down a different route. I also make a little joke about that right at the start. So that's going to be ruined immediately. Please leave this in, Jason. Ruin the joke. Ruin the Gary V and Tim Ferriss joke. Okay, so you can find Scott. Honestly, like, it's easier to just say you can type Scott Belsky into Google and you can find everything about him. He's got a great little website here. His book, The Messy Middle, is out very, very soon. Go to Amazon. It's coming out on the 2nd of October, by the way. Go buy 700 copies of The Messy Middle. It's going to be a great book. It's about finding your way through the hardest and most crucial part of any bold adventure. Jesus, I need this book. And yeah, that's it. Enjoy my conversation with Scott Belsky. Yes, that pause was actually what I did. So, hey, Scott, how's it going, man?
Good. Thanks for having me and great to be here.
So I saw you were on Tim Ferriss's podcast, Gary V's podcast. You must be nervous as hell on here.
Well, actually, I prefer the casual conversations. And Gary and Tim are both kind of old friends. And of course, none of them want to talk about anything in particular. They just want to go all over the place. So I'm just learning to roll with it at this point.
Right. This will be pretty casual, but definitely I'm going to go deep nerd on you, as I am a product strategist, product designer. I'm running a design business. Pretty much like the last 7 years, I've been doing nothing but product work. And I've definitely been following you closely, not in a creepy way, Scott. I promise, not in a creepy way, but following your career closely. Today, I was running the town hall at my office. It's like a monthly thing we do. And I ended up using a slide from a talk you gave, which I don't know how long ago this talk was, but you definitely mentioned that you were going to write a book called The Messy Middle in this talk. And in this talk, you talked about the real journey of running a company, or the real journey of what happens in between the start and the end of creating something. And it really stuck with me because I've been running this company for 7 years and people want to hear about the start. People want to hear about the exit and the end and these bookends. But in the middle, where actually all of the work is happening, there's not a lot of like literature out there because I guess people don't find it that exciting.
Yeah.
It just really stuck with me. Why do you think it's not like popular to talk about that middle part?
Well, for a few reasons. I think, first of all, the middle stuff doesn't make for great headlines. So it doesn't get a lot of coverage, right? In a society so driven by clicks.
True.
And I found this as I started the interviews of different leaders across different industries and artists and writers and others who've had great achievements and long middles to get there. And when I would ask them about their journeys, they didn't really remember the granularity of the middle, in part because they didn't want to. Who would want to remember the sort of tumultuous, mundane, or volatility based on their own mistakes? We typically like to remember the things we want to remember. We don't remember the things we want to forget, right? And yet, at the end of the day, we don't benefit from hearing stories drastically edited for egos and sound bites. What we really want to hear is how those low points were navigated and how those high points were optimized. And that was like the frustration. And that's always how I feel. I always feel like you're most inspired, or at least I'm most inspired when I get frustrated by something or some characteristic of the way people are or the way an industry is, which is ultimately what inspired Behance, my first company. And so that really was the trigger for the project.
And with your first company, with Behance, I think most people listening to this podcast will know about Behance and what it actually is. Did you also completely forget the middle? Was it something that was almost like a shock to you when you went back and thought about it? Or what triggered you to go back and think about that messy part of building that company?
Well, it's funny. I felt this frustration and I started this project, whether it was things I observed or realized in the boardroom or on a call with an entrepreneur at 1 a.m. in the morning or whatever it was. And as I got serious about the project, though, I realized I had to start with my own journey. And I said, okay, well, I bootstrapped the company for 5 years before raising money from venture capital and ran a venture-backed company for almost 2 years and then going during acquisition. I was like, well, let's start with my middle. And I realized I did not remember like really anything specific. Like, it was just as if like it was a big blur. And so I talk about in the book how I actually went to my phone and I went to my photos. You know how every screenshot you ever take, the photos in your phone has become like a day-to-day record of whatever it was you were doing or thinking about in some ways or experiencing. Yeah. And so I just like flicked my way back to the middle of my middle. And I was just blown away by the number of screenshots of mistakes, of things I wasn't happy about in the product, screenshots of people saying they didn't like our product, screenshots of people saying they loved our product. You know, why did I use those screenshots to like provide a sense of reward for our team when no one else really knew what we were doing and we didn't have any revenue or real metrics to celebrate? You know, I started to see pictures of me kind of thin and exhausted. And, you know, I just started having all these memories and it really helped me kind of put some anchor points in my own journey, which was a good sort of start to me dissecting my own process. I also started to interview some of my own colleagues from the early days. And I was sort of like asking them, like, what was I like? And it was interesting to hear, you know, because they could, of course, now be honest with me because most of them are doing other things in the world now. And, you know, this is all a decade old. It was an interesting process. And it definitely started out by reflecting on my own experience.
Like I said, I've been running this business for 7 years. We're a mixture between like a classic consulting company. And we just launched our first product this year. Something that when I was listening to that story right there, when you're actually in the middle, how do you know when you're actually moving forward or how do you know when you're going the right direction? Or can you never know that until you kind of have the hindsight? Or is there something that can tell you, some clues that can tell you that you're moving in the right direction?
Yeah, well, I think you don't have the formal rewards and mile markers and metrics. I mean, that is what makes it a venture or something new, whether it's in a big company or on your own. You only know you're charting new territory when the measures aren't exactly there. And I actually believe you have to, in some ways, short circuit the system and make them when you don't have them. I talk a little bit about short circuiting your reward system. And I share a story in the book about our early days and the fact that we didn't really have many people, again, using our product or paying us. And in fact, every time you typed in Behance into Google, it said, do you mean Enhance? Do you mean Enhance? And one of the earliest goals of the team was to just no longer be a mistake in the eyes of Google. And so that was a near-term motivator because we knew that with enough profiles posted by creatives and enough blog posts linking back to us and that sort of thing, that we could achieve in the algorithm no longer being a mistake. And so one day, you know, one of our engineers on our team, Dave, just went to Google and typed in Behance, and lo and behold, we were no longer a mistake. And then the funny thing is, this is a long time ago, about 6 months later, Yonsei became super popular and we were back to where we started again. So, but you know, it was an example of us short-circuiting our own reward system and building something near term that we could work towards when the traditional measures and rewards were not there. And I think every leader has to do that. Every leader also has to be that narrator of the journey and the merchandiser of the journey. It's not enough to just inspire people with this long-term goal for how the world should be, you know, what the end state of the product should be. On the contrary, you're narrating people through the journey. I liken it to driving in a car on an endless road trip with the windows blocked out and you can't even see anything. You don't know when you're crossing state lines and what monuments you're passing and any sort of milestones, but the driver narrating you through and telling you where you are and what you're doing is enough to keep you sane. Otherwise, you're going to start losing it. That's what leaders of bold ventures and creative projects need to be.
So you said short circuit your team's reward system or the company's reward system. And you're talking about, you know, like you never really know where the end point is. You never really know where you're going, even if you kind of set a mission or whatever companies do. But how did you as a leader at Behance, like how did you kind of keep the momentum up, keep the people motivated when there was no clear end in sight? What were the day-to-day things you did when the windows were blocked? And what were those things you were doing?
Oh, there's so many different things. We had these things called slap bets. I don't know why we called them that, but it was like a quick bet that we would make around something that someone would have to do when we crossed a certain milestone. I mean, one of those was, I've been a lifelong vegetarian and the team wanted me to eat meat for some reason. You know, so I agreed that when we passed a certain number of members, I would eat meat, thinking it was years, if not forever, away. There were a lot of things like that. We would also, whenever we accomplished big projects, all of the to-do lists that were associated with it and all the papers, we would put it up on the wall. We called it our done wall as like a way of celebrating progress with this notion of progress begets progress. And people have to feel they're making progress when it's not clear in the media, when the press aren't celebrating it, when there's nothing really there objectively. You're not making up the win. It's still a real win. It's in the right direction, but you're manufacturing the semblance of it because otherwise it's ephemeral and people won't hold on to it. They won't be surrounded by it. You know, what I also would do sometimes with the team is I would talk through our contingency plans. I would talk through the fact that, hey, like if this doesn't work, we'll do this. And if this doesn't work, we'll have had the best experience and learn how to do this. And I would always narrate and share my own reasoning because I would want to keep the team together. And at the end of the day, that came out of just empathy, knowing what I felt and knowing what other people must feel. I just wanted to talk about it as opposed to pretend it wasn't there.
Right. You said in one of your talks, I think it was at 99U this year, maybe, you were saying you were looking back at your phone and you saw some pictures of yourself at vacation during this sort of middle phase of the company. And you realized that you remembered being never really truly present in those moments, you know, when you were on vacation or when you were kind of trying to take time off from work and just thinking that you're 3 months away from running out of money. How do you as a leader, number one, get yourself through that? And number two, do you kind of tell your employees that you're feeling like that? Or is this something that you're only revealing after the fact?
I think that the lines between personal life and work are blurry and should be in a bold venture. I mean, it's one thing if you have a 9-to-5 job and you kind of keep to yourself, but it's another thing if you are emotionally and physically invested in the work you're doing. People have to know where each other are. You know, you can't just keep your fears to yourself. You have to also know where your team is. I equate a very healthy team to managing an immune system and really knowing when something feels off, when there's like an infection germinating, when the team has caught a cold, you have to act on it. You have to be really feeling that. And in order to do that, you need to know where people are personally. So we had a culture where we would talk openly about some of these challenges or doubts or whatever else. That being said, it's also true that I had to be a source of optimism and energy. You know, I talk in the book about how to manage those trying times and how great leaders will leave every meeting or conversation with energy as opposed to with less, and how important that is. Because as hard as a period is, or as tough as a problem is, or even when you have a meeting when there is no solution, you still have to leave the team with a net positive energy level. That's part of the art of leadership, I think, especially, you know, with product teams trying to figure out very complicated challenges.
It's interesting that you're writing this book, The Messy Middle. When's it actually coming out, by the way?
Yeah, so the book hits shelves and all digital equivalents for October 2nd.
October 2nd, cool. I'll make sure the podcast plops out before then.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting to me to hear about this. I've been following your kind of your messy middle story for a while. And what I realized is that most of the companies that I work with, they're in a perpetual messy middle. Companies at a certain point, there is no end point for most large corporations. A lot of projects, even though they have their releases, they barely recognize their milestones and they're straight back into iterating. In most companies, this messy middle is just day-to-day life forever.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's this kind of question of, aren't we always in the middle? And in fact, I think we want to stay in the middle. A big part of the book at the end, as you may know, is called The Final Mile. And it's really about how to not screw up the final mile and also what changes when a project kind of comes to an end. And it's a very traumatic process, whether it's a failure and in some ways also a success, because your identity becomes tied up in something. You start to be a little choked up in whatever you do next. Whatever you did before is now a bar, and anything that appears to be potentially lower than that bar no longer gets a chance, when in fact, anything that becomes great started as something bad in some ways. So there's a lot of tricky stuff there. And I do talk about the benefits of just staying in the early innings and what that actually means. But I think the messy middle, it's very much a state of mind. Obviously, it's also about what you want to be doing. And are finishes maybe just punctuation points in a journey? Or is it more like the beginning and ends of chapters, right? But what the messy middle really is meant to represent is the volatility that happens, where there's the extreme lows and the extreme highs, and how to turn that aggressive motion into a positive slope, how to make sure you're ultimately heading in the right direction, how you're mining those lows, optimizing the highs, and also how you recognize that you actually aren't your best self, whether you're at a low or a high. At a low, you're likely to make decisions out of fear and out of self-doubt and really out of a state of being that is not your greatest self. And then similarly, when you're at a high, when everything seems to be working, the problem we face is that we start to make decisions thinking that we got it all right. And we falsely attribute the things that we did to the success we're having, or to the thing that worked in our product, or the thing that worked in the way our team is functioning. And that false attribution can throw us off guard. So the self-awareness is actually just as important at both extremes of the volatility, and which is why that messy middle, you know, needs to be so carefully led and managed.
Were there times while you were running Behance where you really thought that this is just not going to work out? Like, what am I doing? Why am I running this thing? Why am I putting all my time into it?
100%. It was 5 years of bootstrapping. And there were many periods during that where I really said, is this going to go anywhere? You know, is this endless expression of energy towards no end? And there were also periods where I said, you know, this could be a lifestyle business. Like, maybe I'm angling for the wrong thing. Rather than try to organize the creative world's work and build a company and a brand that means something to the creative community, hey, maybe it's okay if we just do a conference every year and publish a book and have a series of paper products. What's wrong with that? And I think in some ways, I was just trying to prepare myself for potential lackluster outcome. But at the same time, I really always had conviction in the end state we were working towards. And that's actually a common question that I get from entrepreneurs now, or people in big companies running new projects, is when do you know when to quit versus stick with it?
Yeah.
The answer I always give now is, it's not about how hard something is, or whether there's no end in sight, or whether you're losing hope. It's actually more about the level of conviction you still have in the end state. If you get into the thick of building a product and getting to know your customers and getting to know the market, and more you learn, the more you start to doubt that this actually is a problem, or that this is monetizable, or this is an opportunity, the more that that happens, maybe you should just quit and start something new. On the contrary, if you have more and more conviction, despite how hard it is or how lost you feel, you got to stick with it. And that's the answer that I give.
That's really interesting. I mean, I definitely, in the beginning of my business, right at the very beginning when I wanted it to be a lifestyle business, and then it kind of took me some time to believe that it was worth investing in and investing my time in and actually hiring people in. So it was kind of the opposite for me. I just didn't believe in it in the very beginning. And then I started to believe more and more and more. But there, of course, there are a lot of times where I'm like, you know, what is this direction we're going in? And there's something kind of almost intangible pushing me to keep going. But it's really great great as well with the messy middle, just to see that that's the reality of most companies. That there are times where the leaders are unsure whether it is the right direction or whether it's not the right direction, which is just great to hear.
Yeah, I hope the book, if nothing else, reminds us all that we're not alone.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to kind of mine the volatility for the gems, but it's there. Everyone has it.
You ran during the time, the messy middle of Behance. You were running 99U. You did have these notebooks and there was a lot of stuff going on. Did you ever find that stuff like distracting? Were you doing it for distraction as a backup plan? Or was that all part of a plan?
100%. With what I know now, I'm not sure we would have ever done all of those projects that we did in the beginning. You know, and I think that it's one of those things that what didn't kill us made us stronger, however it nearly killed us. I'm not sure I would recommend to anyone to start a paper product, to bootstrap the company and do conferences and write a book and start a technology company and do it all at once. Ironically, it ended up building the brand in a mission-centric, medium-agnostic fashion. And I actually think that it is easier to do that now than it was 10 years ago because of all these SaaS services and things you can outsource, and you know, Shopify and things like that really didn't exist at the time. But we did have to kill some things. And the tricky part for us was that some of these things I mentioned were successful enough to not logically want to kill, even though they were distracting us. An example was a task management tool called Action Method that some folks may remember. It was for creatives.
I used to use it.
Yeah, I was the biggest user. And we had a number of thousands of customers that were paying us a monthly fee. It was growing at a reasonable rate. But what we realized is that it was never going to be a winner-take-all solution, especially in a field like project management for creatives. There's always going to be different preferences and different seasons that people use different tools. And we realized that it was sucking our energy and it was not going to be the thing that we did to change the world, or at least the creative industry for that matter. And so we said, okay, you know, let's make the difficult decision here. And it was very tough. Customers did not understand what we were doing and were angry. But we also recognized that we were not going to ever fully serve and support where this product needed to be for them. And our team's hearts were not in it as much as they needed to be. And we had to make the tough decision. As a result, Behance's growth became somewhat exponential at that point, at least for a period of time. And I think that's where we kind of went from 50,000 users or whatever to millions. In the book, I talk about the process of killing your darlings and how a big part of the messy middle of product is to know what things to cut, what things to trim down, and we can't escape that responsibility.
Who would you say this book is for, by the way? Because it seems to be a mixture of like a leadership book and, you know, actual product focused. Here's the kind of journey of a product. Who would you say this book is actually for?
Yeah, let me start by saying who it's not for. It's not for people who are just replaying the same playbook, whether it's starting a company that is in the image of another business or another product, or folks that are just taking something and simply scaling it. This is for people undergoing some form of venture, whether it be new terrain with a new product in a big company, whether it be a founding something, writing something new, or embarking on a project in a new way, where they are in fact in this extreme period of volatility, full of that self-doubt, anonymity, ambiguity, you know who you are, as well as recognizing they have to optimize everything that works. That's their chance. This book is for folks who need to be outfitted to succeed in such a journey.
And you mentioned the ability to optimize there. One of the things that you talk about is to endure and optimize. And I thought that really, really clicked with me. The ability to not just one, the ability to actually get through it, to get through this together, to stick together long enough to figure it out, and then to be able to optimize the things that are working along the way. It sounds easy, but in practice, that's something that a lot of companies get wrong.
Yes, it sounds easy. And I think you're right, though, in the midst of the real volatility, the last thing you want to do is focus on something that's working. You know, yeah. If the team is meeting just because it's Tuesday, like, why screw with that? Let's focus on the fires that we need to put out. And yeah. You can actually spend years putting out fires, trying to stay afloat, dealing with issues, worrying about running out of cash, all those other things that happen, and never spend any time on optimizing the things that are actually working. When actually, what we should be doing is the opposite. Your best chance at succeeding in a product or as a team is finding the things that you're doing that are especially compelling, whether it's how you're functioning as a team, how a product is performing, and then it is iterating on those things. It's figuring out, well, why is this working? Why is this attracting attention? Or why is this getting our team to work at their best? How can we institute that more broadly, share practices across teams? How can we make it even better? And so it's a reminder that as leaders of these bold projects, that's what optimization is all about. And a big part of the book, as you know, is really focusing on the optimization of team, product, and your own style, as yourself even.
It's a really big problem for someone like me who's just like, I'm very impulsive. Ideas are flying around my head all the time. And it was actually your book, Making Things Happen, that I read it and it suddenly all clicked with me. It didn't really matter how many ideas I had. I was generating, you know, new things every day. I had new business ideas every day. I was actually running three businesses at the same time. And I read Making Ideas Happen. And it was just this sentence. It was something like, ideas are worthless if you can't make them happen. And this, for me, has been a common theme throughout all of my design work in the last 7 years. And with the business running, is that every time an idea comes up in my mind, every time a business is running well, I want to do something different because it's exciting. And because this messy middle, it does also start to get boring. And the easiest thing to do is to try to do something different. And it's often completely ignoring the enduring and optimizing of that one thing. So that was honestly a huge, huge moment for me, just reading and moving away from the idea that ideas are super important and execution itself is what's important.
You know, when I think back to Making Ideas Happen, my first book, I really do think about what was the inspiration for that book. Frustration inspires me. The frustration that inspired me for that book was the fact that the most creative people in the world seem to want more creativity when it was the last thing they actually needed. Product conferences like TED were all about spreading ideas, and the people with the greatest ideas would go to these conferences and read these books. And it's like, the last thing these people need is more ideas. What they need is more structure. They need guidance towards execution. They need to embark on building the skill set they didn't have in design school or didn't naturally develop as a creative person. And so that was really the rallying cry around not only Making Ideas Happen, but also Behance as a whole.
It's a really big deal. And like for people like me, you know, designers, creative people, whatever I am, I mean, I wanted to be a filmmaker, an illustrator, designer, all of the above. I was the perfect target market for Behance. But it was really the kind of ethos behind 99U and the ethos behind Making Ideas Happen that I guess it focused me a little bit, and it made me realize it is like the easy thing to do is constantly generate things and then constantly be distracted. But the hard thing to do is actually to get these things finished and execute them well. There's a really cool, I think it's Derek Sivers. He has a book called Anything You Want. He says that ideas are just a multiplier of execution. So you can have like a basic idea. And I think a basic idea, for example, would be to start a design agency. In fact, I'd say it's a bad idea. But if you execute it well, if you actually focus on really executing it well, then it can turn into a proper business. It can turn into something special.
A lot of actually the most successful, whether it's agencies or companies or whatever, it's not like the idea was so breakthrough. It was really the execution. I mean, actually, if you even think about it, like think about Apple, right?
Yeah.
Was iPod the first MP3 player? No. You know, a lot of the actual innovations for a company so known for creativity, the innovations are really around the operations and execution. And I oftentimes wonder, for all the fanfare that Steve Jobs has received, and rightly so, but Tim Cook, who was the chief operating officer for so many years, like he's the operations mastermind who figured out how to actually take this concept and execute it in such a better way. And I think that there's something to be said about the underbelly of any idea that we're impressed by, the fact that it's the iceberg underneath is all execution.
Yeah, and I think the problem is just it comes back again to the messy middle and this kind of stuff that you don't see in the headlines. If you read The Verge, if you're reading TechCrunch, you're hearing about the cool new thing. You're often hearing about this crazy new innovation on Kickstarter. You're hearing about all this stuff. And often Apple are ridiculed for being boring,
right?
Really often these days. 2 weeks ago, I released a podcast called Apple is Doomed because I knew everyone would be so, so depressed and bored about what they released this week. And of course they were. It's like, meh, it's the same color, meh. But they'll still be the $1 trillion company. Uh-huh. They'll still sell the most phones because they absolutely know how to nail the basics. And they're never first to the market. It's a huge, huge thing that people somehow skip over.
Yes, indeed it is.
I've been to 99U 3 times now. I think it was at the first one. Was the first one actually in the Lincoln Center or just the second one?
Yeah, the first 2 or 3 were actually at the Time Center, which was like a 350-person audience. And then we upgraded maybe in the years 3 or 4. You were at the first Lincoln Center one?
First Lincoln Center one, yeah.
Oh, wow, okay. Yeah, that was a scary year for us because we were like, okay, does this scale or not?
Can't even remember exactly how I found out about it. I think it was through Making Things Happen.
Okay.
And then onto Behance and then kind of found it through there. But how did you actually, you know, decide to make that leap to this huge location? And was it just like a risk?
You know, it was. I mean, we got to the point in our third year at the Time Center where the tickets sold out like 4 or 5 months in advance. And we started to disappoint more people than we pleased, which is, I guess, a good luxury problem to have. But we were like, okay, there was a part of our team that was saying, this is good. Let's just keep this and we'll share the videos, but let's keep it small and intimate. And there was another cohort of folks who were like, well, how do we know 350 is the right person? Maybe 1,000 is the perfect size. And we debated it and then we decided to take a risk. And I think it actually is the perfect size. We actually have not scaled 99U further since going to Lincoln Center. And you know, it still sells out in advance and it still feels like a community. It doesn't feel too monstrous.
Yeah, I had a really good time the first 2 times I was there. It actually was the first time I ever came to New York was for 99U. Myself and my co-founder, it was just two of us in the company. We went there, we got super inspired, and now we're like a 20-person company here in Berlin. But that was really the start of us trying to learn about, you know, the product world, about the business building world. Met a lot of great people there. And yeah, New York is also great fun. Really good place. Are you still like, you're not like day-to-day involved in 99U anymore, right?
So I'm not day-to-day. It still is part of my unit that I lead at Adobe now, but it has a very capable leadership that is now in charge and evolving it, and it's exceeding my wildest expectations. It's in good hands.
Yeah, it's really crazy. So Scott, before you go, I'd love to leave our audience with a little product nugget, something from the book that's just purely product-focused, because obviously I selfishly took up a lot of time on the leadership stuff. So is there anything from the book, is there anything that could be interesting to the audience here who are very much product-focused?
Well, I think folks will be excited to discover that there is a somewhat hidden book within the book. There is in the middle section in optimization, there is a different shaded and different font section for optimizing product. And I even say in the beginning, you either skipped to this or you want to skip it altogether. But for those, I think, that are listening to us talk now, it sounds like everyone's focused on building and crafting great products. And in this section, I talk about developing the culture of adding and subtracting features in parallel. I talk about the challenges of maintaining simplicity in the product lifecycle, how, you know, a simple product really engages new customers. People gravitate towards a simple product. Then that simple product takes its new users for granted. It starts to add features for power users and to build a business model. And then what happens? Users flock to a simple product. And that's the product lifecycle itself over and over and over. And then I get pretty into depth around what I like to call the first mile, you know, of the product experience, which is really about the defaults, the onboarding, the not only telling people how to do something, but showing them how to do it. And in some cases, doing things for the customer. And I'll guess one little nugget I'll leave everyone with is my 30-second theory, my first 30-second theory, which is about how in the first 30 seconds of every customer's experience of anything, they are lazy, they are vain, and they are selfish. In the sense that we are lazy. We don't want to read something. We don't want to watch a video. We don't want to try to figure something out. This is just better be super seamless and frictionless because I have no faith and I have no time. We're vain in the sense that everyone wants to look good or feel better about themselves. And can a product through things like ego analytics in social consumer products or in enterprise products, can something make me look good in front of my boss really quickly? Can it make my presentation look better? You know, can it give me more insights more quickly? And selfish in the sense that, you know, with 2 lines of code as an engineer, can I achieve something that otherwise I'd have to do from scratch? Can I not have to reinvent the wheel? And I give a lot of examples in the book and talk about how we have too much faith in our customers sometimes. In the first 30 seconds, we need to ground ourselves with these basic human tendencies and realities. And yes, once a customer gets more deeply engaged in our product, they transcend those realities of the first 30 seconds. However, until we get that customer to that level with a hook, we can't forget. We can't make poor decisions and never actually get customers through that first 30-second journey. And so that's one example of many in the product optimization section of The Messy Middle.
That's such a huge point as well, though, because I think a lot of people make the mistake of, I mean, you've seen a lot of product departments, but there's a lot of product departments that use personas, and they'll just forget like basic human needs in these personas, because they'll be like, oh, this is a pro user, you know, they're willing to read all the stuff, they're going to go through everything, but they don't think about the fact that, you know, this lazy, vain, selfish, like, what am I going to get out of it? This is going to be there no matter what type of user it is. So the first 30 seconds is something that I sent my team as soon as I saw it on Medium. So it was a really big deal. I really love that one. Scott, I'm going to do you a favor and end the podcast, but it was a pleasure having you on. Where can people find you on the internet?
I'm easy to find. I invite people to, first of all, share feedback. I want to hear people's thoughts on either Making Ideas Happen or The Messy Middle, but I'm at Scott Belsky, Scott Belsky on Twitter, Instagram, and scottbelsky.com. And hopefully folks will find some gems that help them and reach out.
And I think, like, if you were to pick a number between 1 and 300, how many books should people buy on their day it actually comes out? Like, if they want to be good product people, if they want to be good leaders, like at 200?
Great.
Thanks a lot, Scott.
Thank you.
You legend. Have a good one.
All right, cool.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Product Breakfast Club podcast. Now, I usually feel pretty bad after doing one of these interviews because I realize that I've just kind of like missed out on asking all of the questions I wanted to ask because, you know what, I'm not a professional interview person guy. So there's so many things about products and there's so many things I wanted to ask, but it just didn't happen. And Scott was being so nice and so patient while I really horribly went through the types of questions that I was asking. I just knew that he'd been on Tim Ferriss's podcast in the same week as me. And I know Tim Ferriss is all about asking questions and he reads all these question books, but I'm just like, do you like products, Scott? So I'm very... I'm laughing at myself here because it's so true. Like, it's crazy that that myself and Jake are allowed to have a podcast that people listen to and people come on to. But thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Thanks for supporting it. Thanks for writing in to pbc@ajsmart.com. Really appreciate your support. We really appreciate you giving it 5-star reviews, which help more people find it. If you like this episode, please share it. And, you know, we'll be back next Monday with another podcast. You can find me on Instagram at JIcecream. You can find Jake on Instagram, no, Twitter, at Jake K. And Scott Belsky, you can find this man everywhere. You can just shout Scott Belsky into space and he will appear right next to you, confused. Thanks so much for listening to this. Goodbye, everybody.